This is the Walking Home from the ICU podcast. I'm Kaylee Dayton, a nurse practitioner and ICU consultant. I help teams create awake and walking ICUs through evidence-based sedation and mobility practices. By hearing from survivors, clinicians, and researchers, we'll explore how to give ICU patients the best chance to walk out of the ICU and go home to survive and thrive. Welcome to the ICU Revolution. Okay, it's time to bring it back to the survivors. Not many people can do a true comparison on experiencing being intubated while sedated versus being awake. This episode is with an incredible survivor that shares her journey and insights with us to reaffirm the Bailey method of allowing patients to wake up after intubation before delirium starts. Lara, thank you for so much for coming on the podcast. Do you mind introducing yourself to us?
I'm Lara. I'm 32 years old. I am a med student. I worked as a paramedic before I went to med school, and I'm chronically ill. I have severe asthma, and I think you heard about it because it's on the internet a lot lately. It's Ehlers-Danlos syndrome. And my journey pretty much was that with the chronic illness, I ended up in ICU quite a lot. And I've been intubated and sedated most of the time.
Oh my goodness.
The most days intubated was 9-ish, I think it was. And the very last time, just some weeks ago, it was the first time I was awake. And this was a pretty different experience. I must say everything of it is kind of scary, but this time I was able to advocate for myself while in this state, and this was so different and so much better, I think.
Which is amazing. I think the listeners are probably like, well, what was the difference? Why were you allowed to be awake? Why were you not the first few times? So let's give some context. You and I have been in contact over Instagram for a while.
Yes.
I don't know how you found my Instagram page, but you have shared with me some of your insights into what it was like to be sedated. Do you mind telling us what that's like? Because you probably understand. You work in medicine. You know what the conceptions are, that patients are sleeping, that they're more comfortable, that it's nice and cozy. What's the reality? What was it like for you, at least?
So I can only speak about the stuff I experienced, of course. And you are in such a different mental state. You don't know what's real and what is not, which is scary, which is the most scary part of it. And even when you get woken up and rehabilitated afterwards, it's possible that you're still hallucinating. And it's visual and acoustic. You hear stuff which isn't true. You see stuff which isn't true. And I think this is the hardest part of it, I think, because with the experience in medicine, I pretty much know what's going on, kind of. But then when you're lying there in the bed and with the beeping and stuff, it's completely weird. And I did some rotations when I was in training for being a paramedic. I was on rotation in ICU, and I mean, when it's beeping, you just run and look after it, and usually it's nothing. And when you're lying there, it's like, okay, you're not sure if it's something or
like,
not.
Am I dying?
Yes. Because when you woke up, you just woke up from something you could have died of. It's like, oh my God, is it happening again?
That's terrifying.
Yes, it is.
And I was just at the American Delirium Society conference, and I was starting to ask people, if does anyone know why, when patients get lost in this alternative reality, why is it so scary? I mean, I think it's like you said, it's scary to not know what's real and what's not. I think even if I was seeing rainbows and I wasn't sure if it was real or not, I would be concerned. But what was the nature of your reality? Was it graphic and gruesome, like so many report?
Yes, it was graphic. I mean, it always depends on which sedation you're on. This is what my experience was. The most scary part was with ketamine.
Interesting. Thank you. Because there's such a big movement towards ketamine.
Yes.
But we know it causes hallucinations. It's startling. Yes, it doesn't suppress respiratory drive in the same way. I think that's why we're getting excited. It may not last as long, but it causes hallucinations. So why would you take patients that are so vulnerable to delirium at risk of having terrifying hallucinations and give them a hallucinogenic?
Yes. I mean, because of elastalas, I'm also in chronic pain, and I happen to had pneumothoraxes, which were treated with, this chemical talcum pleurodesis in one lung cavity, mm-hmm. Which is not up to date anymore because it makes severe pain. Oh, and this is what happened to me. And so when I'm in an asthma attack, I have this really, really great pain in my chest as well with the asthma, which is really hard. And there was this one time where I got this ketamine, but with benzodiazepine.
Oh my God.
It was fine because this time I was in an operative ICU, mm-hmm. which were handled by different doctors, and they kind of got this better level between these two drugs. And after this, I was pain-free, and this was great. I mean, it was the very first time. And I wasn't hallucinating, but later on, when I was on this drug, because they love to use it when you're having an asthma attack.
Uh-huh.
And need to get intubated, they use this rather than other ones. But when I was sedated and intubated for these 9-ish days, I have these pictures in my head and this memories, these really weird memories, which don't make sense, but it's really scary.
And they're real to you.
Yes. And it's interesting because the day before I watched a documentary, and it really caught me emotionally. And I went with these completely different emotions in this new situation. And during this whole time sedated, I had these same emotions, and I woke up with them as well. And because they were kind of scary beforehand, and I was scared all the time I was sedated, and I got out of it in the same emotion. And this is so weird. Like another time I had this, it was when the new real, the movie Lion King was on, the new one.
Uh-huh.
And I had this Just Can't Wait to Be King song in my head.
Uh-huh.
And this whole time, it was just playing in my mind the whole time. And then I got into this situation and I woke up with it and I had it in my head. And this is so weird.
How strange. Oh, another survivor said she'd been watching a movie about fish with her kids the day before. And then throughout her whole delirium, she believed that she was turned into a fish. She'd never see her kids again. That's so, I don't know how the mind works that way, but that is interesting. Yes.
And
but,
you know,
but I would think that that's a happy song.
Yeah, I know.
Did it feel happy?
Yeah. During this time, I think it wasn't that scary.
Good.
I think it was just 4 days I was intubated there. But yeah, it wasn't as scary, but I couldn't get this song out of my head for the next couple of days afterwards as well. It was just, and now all the time I hear this, I remember this time there in ICU and
just shudder.
Yeah, a little bit.
Like the song's ruined for you.
You know, there is a scene and they made it for 3D movies where all these animals go around and you think you are in a kaleidoscope.
Uh-huh.
And during my time there, it was like always going through this kaleidoscope.
Oh, wow.
And similar, it was a second time when I had this bad emotions. It was just different colors, but it was still kind of, yeah, going through a kaleidoscope and not knowing where you're at. And
it was this happy, pretty thing. It turned into like a scary, startling thing. Yes. Where all these images are blurred. And then you mentioned before that you self-extubated at one point.
Yes, I am. The one I was awake. Wasn't it? I don't know which
scene. You just mentioned, you said it's terrible to have delirium and you're thrashing, you're hitting, you pull out your breathing tube. That's what you mentioned.
It was when I was there, that's long time. At first, I was intubated for a day, I think it was, and they extubated me, and I had another episode just after a couple of hours and was reintubated. Mm. And yeah, at some point, I pulled out the tube after 9 days. And I don't remember a thing because I was in my kaleidoscope.
Right.
And the first thing I remember was I kind of sat there in this bed and the doctor was there and the nurse, and they would tell me, oh, you just slept 9 days. And I was, no, you're kidding. Because I couldn't believe it, because it was the very same situation I was after they extubated me the very first time after 1 day.
Uh-huh.
And I had this deja vu.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
I
was just here.
The situation before, I don't know, because I was so confused with everything. And yeah, I was then extubated after 8 days, and it was just weird because there was this huge gap, and I couldn't figure what was happening, what the process was when I was asleep, and they were telling me all the stuff for the next 2 days, and I couldn't remember the thing that they told me this already, and I was really confused. But I have to say that it's not diagnosed because of insurance problems, but they think I have this poor metabolizer syndrome. This polymorphism where you don't metabolize the drugs as fast as normal people.
Uh-huh.
And because of this, I think it's a little bit longer that takes me to get out of this delirium by this drugs.
Yeah, that makes absolute sense. And we see that at the bedside, everyone responds differently to the drugs. They come out of it differently. The timing is different. So mm-hmm. I'm sure there is a genetic component to how you respond to these medications. The loss of time is something that survivors have frequently mentioned to me, even if they didn't have traumatizing delirium. Mm-hmm. Just the fact that they lost time. My husband had an endoscopic procedure a couple of weeks ago. He went in like 3 p.m. and came out, you know, at like 5:30, and he was walking, talking. He was fine. But then the next day he's like, what happened? He doesn't remember anything. And it just kind of bugs him. And mm-hmm. I thought that was a few hours. That was an afternoon, not a week or weeks for some of these survivors. That loss of time, I don't think, I don't understand it, right? But I think until you experience it, you don't appreciate how traumatizing that alone can be, to know that you lost that time. You did things, or things were done to you.
Yes.
That you have no idea of.
Exactly. And I know, because people told me that in this state, under this drugs, I can be very aggressive. better, which bugs me because I don't want to be this way. I want everyone to be fine, to be happy, and I really, yeah.
It's not who you are.
Yes, but the thing is, people think I am.
So labeled that way and treated that way.
Yes. And
when you went to the ER this last time, were you intubated in the ER? And how did you approach intubation? How did you advocate for yourself?
No. I was in ICU already. I had this infection. It was infect triggered. And by now I know that there's a different component to it, what gets me intubated, because we know now after this last episode. It's because when they put me on non-invasive ventilation, and I'm getting hypercapnic. Is it how it's called?
Hypnic?
When CO2 gets too high in your blood, then I get drowsy and tired and so on. And when then they put up the pressure of the non-invasive ventilation, my vocal cords will just shut.
Oh.
So there's this laryngospasm. And the only option is to intubate them.
Yeah, it's a crisis.
Yes. And they did that, and they needed to put me on muscle relaxants for this. And when they wore off, they woke me up again. So it was kind of straight away. It was like late in the night, and yeah, a couple of hours later I was woken up again. And I don't have a problem with waking up with the tube in, really. It's because it depends on the drug I'm on. And this time it was just propofol. And then I knew, okay, we're in this situation now.
Yeah.
So then I woke up and I was able to advocate for myself. And I was like, okay, let's wait another hour for this drugs to wean off. And then let's take it out. And when they took it out, I had another laryngospasm straight away because of this
relation.
Yes. And they had to re-intubate me. And a couple of hours later, I was awake again. And then I was awake for the next couple of days because it worked out. And it was the very first time this hospital did that
with anybody.
With anybody.
This and because did you tell them that's what you wanted?
No, it wasn't communicated that way, but because of the first time I was awake and I was able to tolerate the tube.
The first time they didn't expect you to stay on it for longer than a few hours. So they wanted to get you extubated. So they had you awake, and they realized that worked for you. And that works for a lot of people, to let them wake up right afterwards. But they had never had the occasion to do that or to try that approach. Or they had never tried it before. I would say, I don't say that they didn't have the occasion to. I'm sure they had other occasions in which it would have been really beneficial to let patients wake up right away. But they just hadn't.
Yes.
Maybe change their perspective. What do you think?
I don't know. I had the feeling a lot of the nurses there and the doctors, they were like, ooh, interesting. Interesting situation. But some nurses, they were annoyed because they didn't have this sleeping patient.
Or a patient they believed to be sleeping.
Yes, exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
And you were able to write, or were you texting on your phone? You texted me. You sent me a picture of yourself. You took a selfie. You sent it to me via Instagram, and you said, it's really annoying that I'm intubated, but this is so much better. I'm awake and I'm oriented.
Yes, it was.
And I used that picture in my presentation for the American Delirium Society conference. And said, this is what the Bailey method looks like. Polly Bailey is my mentor, and she's been letting patients wake up after intubation for almost 30 years and seeing what they need.
Yes.
And so I I used you as an example to say the patient herself, while she's intubated, saying this is so much better and she's had it both ways.
Yeah.
And that's powerful.
Yes. I don't know if they will try it on other patients. I know from my friend, she's intubated because of her severe asthma as well. Mm-hmm. All the time. And she's like, no, I don't want to know anything. I want to be asleep the whole time. But I had in the past that you are not this asleep. You know, when you wake up from when the sedation is a little low, then or the body is needing more to be really asleep because it knows the drug already, you know, when the body needs more and more to be.
Oh, you build up a tolerance. Yeah.
Yes. You build the tolerance. And I had it before that I knew what's going on and I wasn't in a delirium, but I was asleep. I couldn't move. I couldn't do anything, but I could hear people around me.
Uh-huh.
And to experience this, and I mean they were fine except for I think one that didn't talk to me, because you really should talk to people that are sedated and intubated. You should really should, because you never know what they can experience.
Yeah.
And it's scary when you're like touched or they take away your blanket and it's like, what's happening now? And you're thrown onto your side, you get a lumbar puncture and it's like, what the hell is going on?
And you're totally vulnerable.
Yes.
And I'm sure it's got to be, that's probably one of the most dehumanizing parts, is to have all that done without being informed and communicated to. And
yeah,
that's really good. What did it mean to you this time to be able to communicate to your providers?
A lot, because even though I couldn't, you know, sign stuff, I had my dad and my sister come in for things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But I was able to say, no, I don't want it this way. Please, let's try a different attempt. And even the basic stuff, like, you know, when you're sedated and you lie there and you really need to
mm-hmm.
you cannot tell anyone, and it's so depressing.
Yeah. That is, I mean, when I do trainings, that's when you go through possible causes of agitation.
If you've been listening to this podcast, you're likely convinced that sedation and mobility practices in the ICU need to change. The ICU community is facing incredible difficulty with the trauma from the pandemic, staffing crisis, and burnout. We cannot afford to continue practices that result in poor patient outcomes, more time in the ICU, higher healthcare costs, and greater workload for the ICU team. Yet the prospect of changing decades of beliefs, practices, and culture across all disciplines of the ICU is a daunting task. How does this transformation start? It can begin with a consultation with me to discuss your team's current practices, barriers, and to formulate a plan to help your ICU become an awake and walking ICU. I help teams master the ABCDEF bundle through education, consulting, simulation training, and bedside support. Let's work together to move your team into the future of evidence-based ICU care. Click the link in the show notes of this episode to find out more.
When you turn on sedation, someone comes out agitated, I'm trying to get people to think through pain, they're afraid, they're delirious, blah, blah, blah. But one of the things that elicit is bowel movement.
Yes.
So often patients come out panicked and they're trying to tell us something, and it's because they have to, you have a bowel movement, but we don't expect that. We don't allow them the opportunity to tell us, and then we restate them, and they are just panicked about it still on the inside.
Yeah, because you really don't want you don't want to shit yourself.
Yeah, you're a grown adult. You've been independent. You don't do that. So that's so stressful.
Yes. And this is the most basic thing. And it's so depressing to not be able to communicate this. And
so the ICU that I come from, there is a toilet in the corner of the room that's very accessible. So a lot of times when we're getting patients up to go on a walk or even to the chair, we don't even have to disconnect the ventilator. They can just walk over to the toilet. If they're really reliable, we can close the curtain. They can do their business. Yeah. Even though they're intubated, they can kind of do their business by themselves, wipe themselves, wash their own hands, or we can have a commode. I mean, a lot of patients can toilet themselves.
Yes.
And that's so different. And ultimately that is easier for nurses than having to clean up everything in the bed while the patient's still in the bed.
Yes.
Completely flaccid.
Yes. And, you know, this is one part you don't think about when straight away when you are out of 9 days of intubation, sedated. Mm-hmm. But later on, it's like, how did they do this? I know how they did what's happening then because I worked in an ICU. But it's when you work there, it's normal. It's completely normal, and you don't think a thing about it. No? But when you're lying there, it's a completely different situation.
You feel violated.
Yeah.
I would imagine even if you didn't have delirium that led you to believe that you were being sexually assaulted, just knowing that all of that was done without your knowledge and I guess your consent to a certain degree, that all of your business was being closely investigated the whole time while you were not conscious.
Yeah, no.
That must be disturbing.
Yes, but I never thought about it being sexually.
Good.
No.
Some do.
Yes, I know. I heard about
past
it.
Past trauma.
I don't have this experience.
Yeah, thank goodness.
Yes.
But it's still, you come out and you're like, oh, I know how that was done, but I wasn't a part of that. But yeah. It's still my body. Absolutely. Well, what recommendations would you give to ICU clinicians that want to help patients be awake, calm, compliant, comfortable on the ventilator? You said that you have pain in your chest during asthma attacks. This was an asthma attack. One of the hangups to letting patients be awake, clinicians will say, but it's not right to let them be in pain. There's a misconception, especially with nurses, that sedation is pain management, that if they're not moving and they're not showing signs of pain, they're not in pain. So there you were awake, you have chronic pain, you're in a painful situation, but you were awake. So how did you help your team navigate pain management?
The clinic I was in, the very first time I was there, I was in their pain clinic. So there is a really good pain management program in this clinic. And I wasn't off any sedation. I was a little bit on propofol and sufentanil.
Yep.
For tolerating the tube for this long. And with this little bit of sufentanil, it was okay. And if it wasn't, I got a little bit extra, but I was able to tell them and I was ringing the bell and they were giving me extra pain medication. It was fine. But
that is the ABCD of bundle A, the very first letter. If people really like to go sequentially. So A is assess, prevent, and treat pain. And I really insist that that's best done when patients can tell us what they're experiencing, what they need, what's helped, and help guide that. So this is not a sedation-less approach. This is not, especially not an opioid-less approach. This is giving the tools or the reins into the patient's hands so they can tell us what they want and need. The objective is to have patients be awake, oriented, communicative, autonomous, telling us, and that is exactly what we did. And so fentanyl boluses can help, a low-dose fentanyl drip. All of those are cool, like great tools that can be used to achieve the presentation that you had of a patient being communicative, oriented, delirium-free, and calling the shots. So I would just insist that we can and must do proper pain management, but mm-hmm. oftentimes that's much more easily facilitated when the patients can tell us what they need.
Yes.
And you did fine. You didn't yeah. need to be a RAS of -3 to have your pain managed. Like, that doesn't make sense. But culturally, there's this belief that the less patients move, the more comfortable they are. But
yeah.
you were deeply sedated in the past and you were in a lot of pain. So
yeah, I have this once where I was intubated and they were trying to get me awake. But at this time, they didn't know I was having this problems with sedation medication that I wean off it very slowly. And my parents, they visited me and they went to the staff and told them that they fear that I'm in pain. And I don't know if I was, because I was, at this time I was sleeping, but they were saying I was a little bit agitated, a little bit not so still, and making faces.
And they know you.
At ease.
Yeah. I think families can be a really good gauge of pain. I mean, there's so many different reasons to be agitated, to be moving, but the families know their loved ones.
Yes.
But sometimes the clinicians turn up sedation when we see movement, when really they need more sedation, more pain management. So it just feels like your last situation was best case scenario. And after, what was the difference in your rehabilitation process?
This time I was, so I tell you of the 9 days with sedation first. After this, I woke up, I couldn't hold up my phone. I couldn't grab my phone. I was so weak. I couldn't lift my head. I couldn't sit up for a day. When they were trying to mobilize me to stand beside the bed, I couldn't hold myself up. My feet didn't know how to hold the weight, and they didn't know the pressure under the feet anymore. And mm-hmm. my you know how it feels when you're lying on your hand and it falls asleep and then it pins and needles when it wakes yeah. up. So when I stood up the first time, it was pins and needles in my foot, because they didn't know the sensory anymore. And it was so weird and it was really hurtful, and I was a little bit scared to do this again.
Yeah. One survivor said it was like walking on shards of glass.
Yes, it is.
And I, as a nurse practitioner, I never would have thought of that.
It is.
Add that to the list of reasons why to keep our patients moving.
Yes, it is. And this from this ICU, I was moved to a hospital close to my city because it was far away, because I was in rehabilitation on the coast where it happened. Mm-hmm. And they moved me back to my place where I live. And they put me in the other ICU again for some days because they didn't read the paper from the other hospital and trying to figure out what's wrong with me. And yeah, this is another story.
Yeah.
And in this time, I think the physiotherapist came, they came once a day for 10 minutes.
After being sedated for 9 days, that's all you got.
Yeah, for the next 5 days, I think. And I was on the cables and I was trying to stand beside the bed. And every time they came in and saw that, they were like, oh, no, you need to lie down. And I was like, what?
I've got to get going. I've got to get out of here.
And I was trying to walk beside the bed on the spot, like just trying to get my feet to know the pressure again.
You're trying to rehabilitate yourself.
Yeah. And in this 10 minutes, the physiotherapist came in. They brought this sitting bike to get my strength back. So it took me, I think, 2 weeks to walk 100 meters.
Well, we had a recent study come out looking at dose of early mobility. but the two groups, it was a team study, and the two groups were very close. They only had 12 minutes of difference, and they had both had been a median RASS of -3 for 3 to 5 days. So, I mean, the methodology was questionable, but I didn't see a difference between the two. But hearing your, that approach to rehabilitation, 10 minutes a day after 9 days of deep sedation, that just can't be enough. And that's probably why it took so long. Had you had more frequent and aggressive rehabilitation, I just, there's no question in my mind that you would have been walking longer, further, sooner.
Yes. I was glad my mom brought me this TheraBand.
Brilliant.
I was able to do some things in my bed, and I did with this, but it wasn't by the hospital rehabilitation. My sister, she's a physiotherapist.
Okay.
And she knows stuff. She sent me pictures, what I should do, and videos like how to do it the right way.
Yeah, that's validating, because when I'm working with teams, we're working on family packets, and we're putting in pages that go along with those bands that we're going to provide to say to the loved ones, to say, you can help with rehabilitation. These are things that we can do in the bed when we're not even in the room.
Yes.
But that was your family's instinct.
Yes. And, you know, this time around, when I was awake, I was sitting in my bed the whole time, holding myself straight up. I was weak afterwards. I had my problems with sitting up at my desk straight for studying for exams, because straight away after I went out of hospital, I had exams.
Yeah.
It's
you annoying. Also have Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, so yeah. Or EDS. So that would, I would just think that you would be even more important to mobilize early on.
Mm.
You have weak connective tissue, you have chronic mobility issues. So preserving your baseline is really important.
Yes. But being awake, I was able, you know, they had this taller chair beside my bed where I was able to go when I needed, and I was able to work out with the physiotherapist during this time, and it was fine. It wasn't long, but I was able to do something every day, and I didn't get rusty.
Yeah.
I didn't get rusty so much. And, you know, the day after I was extubated, I was able to go on a different ward, a normal ward, but on the surgery ward. But they had a big bathroom, and I went and washed my hair, had a shower. And it was the next day after they extubated me, and I couldn't see this the time around where I was the last time when I was intubated for this 9 days.
Yeah, those things that we don't think about in the ICU. I mean, the value of a shower. I mean, I've showered intubated patients, but I haven't seen other ICUs have shower rooms on the unit.
No, they didn't have, but yeah, we had to walk across the hospital to this other ward.
But you could walk.
Yeah, I could.
Yeah, and amazing.
This was so valuable to me.
Yeah, it's for your sense of sanity, humanity, dignity, comfort, all of it. No, it makes absolute sense. When do any of us go weeks without showers?
Yeah.
Real running water. But your insight and your experiences of having had it both ways is so invaluable, from the delirium to the IC cord weakness to the hygiene to the autonomy to the communication. I mean, night and day, you get it. You know it all.
Yes. And I know how I want to approach patients when I'm a doctor, and in this country we have a university hospital that is working with intubated patients that are awake, but it's just this one hospital. Yeah. And I don't know of any other hospitals that do that. So I was really glad to that this other hospital now gave me this opportunity to get this different experience.
I mean, absolutely.
I I don't know if it happens again, if it will be this way, because it always depends on the people working there the day.
You can also, I mean, at least here in the States, we have advanced directives. We can say what our wishes and wants are. We can tell our primary, our advocates what our preferences are. So past survivors that I talked to, they've written out orders protecting themselves from unnecessary sedation. Mm. So I hope you have that opportunity too. I hope you never end up in the ICU again, first of all. But you have some chronic conditions where you know that could happen. And I've had other survivors. One episode three of my podcast is from a 3 times ARDS survivor. Oh, the first time she had the classic treatment and she had a terrible experience in rehabilitation. And then she had an attorney draft up documents to protect her from sedation. The next 2 times she was awake texting, your same experience.
Yes.
And she said, I'm not afraid of ventilators. I'm not afraid of the endotracheal tube. I'm terrified of sedation.
Yes.
Sedation is what I'm afraid of. And so thank you for sharing your insights with us. I wish you the best of health and luck. We're all behind you in this. So if anyone wants to reach out to the ICU revolutionists, if you end up in the ICU again, we've got your back.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Laura. Keep us posted. Good luck in your studies. Yeah. You're going to be a great doctor.
Hope so.
Schedule a consultation for your ICU, as well as find supportive resources such as the free ebook, case studies, episode citations, and transcripts, please check out the website www.daytonicuconsulting.com.